I'd like to welcome you to the second keynote session in this annual meeting and in the symposium. My name is Renate Grenvold-Bugge. I have the pleasure to introduce this keynote session and the speaker and discuss it. The title of this session is The Haunting Father, Shakespeare's Hamlet, and Freud's Moses. The time schedule will be as yesterday. We will be here from 11:30 till 12:45, and it will be approximately 45 minutes for the keynote speaker, about 10 minutes for the discussant, and then we will have time left for to open the floor. It is a great pleasure to welcome you as keynote speaker at ISTU's annual meeting, Lilian Munk-Rösing. I'd like to say a few words about your accomplishments to the field and what has made it so exciting to invite you as keynote speaker. Lilian Munk-Rösing is PhD and Associated Professor at the Department of Arts and Cultural Studies, University of Copenhagen, as well as literary critic at the Danish daily newspaper Information. She has published three books in Danish, one on childhood, one on gender, and one on law and love. All three combining psychoanalysis with literary and cultural criticism. Related to the topic of today's talk are two papers published in English. It's The Phantom of the Father and The Symptom of Love, that was published in 2004, and To Be and Not to Be, both published in the Journal of Culture and the Unconscious. So, I'd like to welcome you and give you welcome you up here.
Yes, so I'm going to talk to you today about the haunting father. And I'll be trying to question this figure through Shakespeare's Hamlet and Freud's Moses and monotheism. Now, claims have been made that we are living today in a fatherless society, in which the symbolic paternal authority, what Jacques Lacan would call le nom du père, meaning both the name of the father and the no of the father, that is the symbolic castration, the father saying no to the symbiotic relation between mother and child. Claims have been made that this symbolic paternal authority has disappeared. Robert Bly has coined the term of sibling society, and Judith Flower McCannell calls it, with the title of one of the books, The Regime of the Brother, drawing our attention to the fact that brotherhood is actually one of the founding words of modern bourgeois society. You know, the slogan of the French Revolution actually was Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, Liberty, Equality and Brotherhood. One reaction to the ultimate consequences of this slogan of freedom, equality and brotherhood has been a neoconservative trend to call for authorities, strong fathers, prohibitions, severe laws, a reinforcement of the superego, psychoanalytically speaking. So, one might ask, has the ghost of the father returned? Well, in psychoanalysis, as I see it, the authority of the father has always had something ghostly about it. The authority of the father relies to a certain degree on the absence of the father. Only when absent in flesh and blood, he can become the fantasy of the strong and infallible paternal figure. To Lacan, of course, this name of the father, the symbolic father, is clearly separated from the actual person of the father. And in Freud, paternal authority is a result of the killing of the primal father, as he describes it in Totem und Tabu and in Der Mann Moses. Now this idea of the primal father is the idea of the father who was the one who could kill and fornicate and feast as much as he wanted. Lacan calls him the father of enjoyment, until he was then killed by his jealous sons, who then felt so guilty for this murder that the strength of their guilt became the force of their obedience to the law. In Freud's mythic construction, only as dead the father installed himself in the sons as the symbolic paternal authority. Now, are we today in a situation where the decline of the symbolic father has brought back this primal father of enjoyment? What message does the ghost of the father have for us? Be it the ghost of Moses, who was actually, according to Freud anyway, killed by his people, or be it the most famous ghost in literary history, old Hamlet. I'm going to try in this talk to confront those paternal ghosts, including perhaps the ghost of Freud himself, to find what is their testimony, what is their legacy, arguing that Freud's Moses, as well as Shakespeare's Hamlet, could be read as tokens of an ethics of the other and an ethics of the unconscious, as an alternative to both the authoritarian paternal superego and its obscene reverse, the primal father. And talking about the primal father, one must never forget Lacan's dictum that one of the names of the primal father is woman. Now first, the return of the primal father, or the question whether he is returning. The Belgian Lacanian psychoanalyst Paul Verhaeghe has written an essay with a long and telling title. It's called The Collapse of the Function of the Father and Its Effects on Gender Roles. Verhaeghe departs from the commonly accepted sociological thesis that the paternal authority is collapsing. This collapse implies the collapse of gender and generational difference. A whole culture has gone teenage and unisex. The ideal person of our time has no gender and no age. Everyone wants to be one of the boys, whether male or female, whether 15 or 60 years old. To Verhaeghe, as a Lacanian, the function of the symbolic father is to found and maintain difference. The quintessential essential differences being gender and generation. This function could be performed, though, by other instances than the father. For instance, you'll find a society in which the basic differences, gender and generation, are installed when the small child is moved from one clan to another. So one might do without the symbolic father, but not without that founding of difference that in a patriarchal society he is the one to represent. We can't do without the function of installing difference. Ultimately, this would lead to psychosis, but other metaphors than the paternal might fill it out. Now, what is happening in late modernity, according to Verhagen, is the exit of the symbolic father, resulting in the return of the primal father. And I quote Verhagen: "Instead of the real primal father, it is the symbolic function which is destroyed, thereby setting loose what Lacan calls the primal anal father, a figure who is only on the lookout for his own jouissance," unquote. So the point is that revolting against the symbolic paternal authority might subject us to a much worse father, the father of enjoyment. The idea is that we are somehow living through the Freudian myth of the primal father in the reverse. Instead of killing the primal father, thereby introjecting him as a symbolic paternal authority, that would be the Freudian superego, we are destroying the symbolic paternal authority, thereby inviting the primal father to return. Sociologically, we can observe the primal father returning in the figure of the leader of the gang. In cinema, we see him returning in such figures as Darth Vader in Star Wars, or the pervert paternal figures in the films by David Lynch. Think, for instance, of Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet, or Willem Dafoe in Wild at Heart. Even if Willem Dafoe has recently kind of atoned for all his crimes against women in Lars von Trier's Antichrist, but that's another story. Well, now getting to Freud's Moses, Freud's book on the man Moses and mother Jason. The Freudian myth of the primal father can be found not only in Totem und Tabu, but also in Freud's very last book, The Man Moses and Monotheism, written from 1934 to 1938, that was really the last thing Freud wrote. And to me, that's a very moving idea, that this old man, and he was really old, he was sick, he was on the run from the Nazis, and then he was just obsessed with writing this book, obsessed with this one figure, Moses, and with proving that Moses was actually not a Jew, he was an Egyptian. Now, Freud uses Moses to tell his story of the killing of the primal father as the condition for the installment of the symbolic father. But at the same time, it becomes a story of the fantasy of the primal father as the condition for patriarchal law. With the law comes the fantasy of the position of unrestricted enjoyment.
And that's the position that Lacan has shown to be taken among others by woman, the patriarchal idea of woman as the one who has no super ego, who has this kind of unrestricted access to some kind of other mysterious enjoyment. So, to me, this is an important point, the point that the law implies the fantasy of the position of unrestricted enjoyment. According to Freud, the Jews in the desert were not only being discontent with Moses, we know about that from the scriptures, but they actually killed him. This is Freud's explanation of the importance of law in Judaism. By killing the primal father, the Jews had this dead father and the guilt installed in them, which is the base of the Freudian superego. To Freud, as you know, decent people are father murderers. There can be no lawful culture without the killing of the primal father. So that's why he kind of needs this myth of Moses being killed in order to explain the importance of law in Judaism. In his contemporary context, 1938 in Europe, Freud, of course, sees a decline of decency. Like Verhaerhe somewhat later, he sees a collapse in the function of the father, that is, in this symbolic internalized father, the superego. According to Verhaerhe, Freud's solution to this collapse is a reinforcement of the paternal figure. But Verhaerhe warns that this solution is, in the end, a fascist solution. In the man Moses, though, I find the ghosts of Moses and Freud, that is, Moses as he haunted Freud during his last years, and Freud as his voice is addressing us now from beyond the tomb. I find these ghosts having another message for us, the message of an ethics not based on authority and law, but rather on alienation and love. Now, besides the point that Moses was killed by his people, Freud has two other important points about Moses in his book. The first one being Moses was actually two persons, and the other one being Moses was an Egyptian. So Freud's Moses is basically foreign, split, and killed. Now, Moses being two persons is logically related to the killing business. When the one Moses was killed, the other took over, so no one really noticed. But what I find more interesting is the very structure of doubled or split identity. It's a structure which is already there in the scriptures, of course, where you'll find at least two different authors, the Jehovahist and the Elohist, according to their naming of God. One calls him Jehovah, the other one calls him Elohim. So Freud's idea is basically that the Moses who was killed was the Egyptian Moses, who actually brought to the exiled Hebrews the religion of monotheism, that is, the idea of one universal and rather abstract God. The other Moses was a priest of the Jews in Midian, who joined the Jews coming from Egypt during the Exodus. And their God was, according to Freud, no real monotheistic God, but a local volcanic God called Jehovah.
So in this story of Freud's, it is not only Moses who is actually two persons, it's also the Jewish God being split in the universal abstract God of monotheism, and then this local volcanic God who is, according to Freud, a remainder of polytheism and a harsh, capricious, punishing God, a figure somewhat like the primal father. Freud's claim that Moses was an Egyptian, not a Jew, is probably the most scandalous, crazy, and to me also the most beautiful idea of his book. Freud begins his book on Moses by saying that taking away from his people a man who is their most precious treasure is not something that he likes to do. So then one might ask, why does he do it? Why is this so important to Freud that he uses the very last energy of his life to produce etymological and historical fantasies to prove this? In the situation of the Jewish people in Europe at that time, one might find it more natural to strengthen their identity than to split it, saying, as Freud does, that the core of your identity is actually something foreign. What Freud is saying is not only that Moses was originally an Egyptian, but that the very idea of monotheism was something Egyptian that Moses brought to the Jewish people. Just as he brought the tradition, according to Freud, of circumcision, which in this way is also taken away from the Jews as something originally and genuinely theirs. So, as I read Freud's book on Moses, what he is systematically doing by killing and splitting and foreignizing Moses is a deconstruction of identity. There is no stable, genuine, and homogeneous core in Jewish identity, be it Moses, monotheism, or circumcision. Still, Freud's book is also a great defense of monotheism, or rather of a secularized monotheism, meaning universalism, meaning subscribing to the universal God rather than to the local God. Or translated into the cultural climate of today, meaning focusing on the universal traits of the subject rather than its particular ethnic, religious, sexual, etc. identity. So, to me, Freud's critique of polytheism must today be understood as a critique of particularism, the understanding of the subject as a particular identity, as a Jew, Greek, Roman, Christian, Muslim, gay, queer, etc. Now, the Egyptian universalism was, according to Freud, an imperialist universalism. It was the idea of one empire, one pharaoh, one god. As the Egyptian empire expanded, the idea of the sun god as the one god developed. The Jewish universalism, on the other hand, is certainly not related to the expansion of an empire. Rather, it goes with the state of exile and migration. From Freud's point of view, there's only one thing wrong with Jewish universalism, and that is its restriction to one chosen people. Here Freud actually, and perhaps surprisingly, sees the breakthrough of real universalism in St. Paul and his famous dictum from the Galatians. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. So at the beginning of Christianity with St. Paul, Freud sees the possibility of a genuine universalism being based on the universal subject as the split subject without being restricted to one chosen people. But Christianity, according to Freud, quickly declines into just another pagan polytheism with all of its saints and its miracles and its cannibalistic Eucharist. So, in Freud's book on Moses, the state of exile and migration, just as the state of being split and traversed by something foreign, becomes the allegory of the universal human condition. That is, by splitting, killing, and Egyptianizing Moses, by showing universalism to have developed from the idea of a great empire to the idea of wandering migrants, Freud propagates for what one might call a nomadic universalism as an alternative to both the imperialist universalism and the multicultural particularism of today. So Freud's book on Moses is really much, as I read it, about the couple of the symbolic and the primal father, staged both in the story of the killing of Moses, and in the couple of the universal God and the local Jehovah. But in its overall tale, it presents us with a third alternative. It's not that we have to choose between symbolic paternal authority and the horror of the primal father. There is an alternative, which is an ethics based on the universality of the subject, understood as its very being split and exiled and foreign to itself. So let us now turn to the fatherly ghost in Shakespeare's Hamlet. Situated as we are in Elsinore, in the shadow of the castle of Kronborg, we could hardly ignore the voice of that ghost. And it's a funny thing that the paternal ghost that we find today materially represented in Kronborg is the kind of ghost that I'm actually scared to see awakening in Europe today, the ghost of populist nationalism. If you have been to the castle, you might have seen in the cellar, you have the statue of Holger the Dane, who is ready to wake up and defend his patria when needed. But instead of leaning on this figure of stone, which is actually what the successful right-wing populist party of Denmark is doing for the moment, I would suggest that we turn to the more immaterial ghost of old Hamlet, being nothing but a voice talking to us from an old text. Now, the voice of old Hamlet might seem a perfect allegory of the dead father as the superego, the moral imperative telling Hamlet what to do. Revenge this foul and most unnatural murder, as it's put in Shakespeare's pentametric verse. Now, you might see this as the perfect allegory of the moral imperative telling Hamlet what to do, old Hamlet's brother Claudius has not only killed him, but also married his wife Gertrude, young Hamlet's mother. If we take seriously Freud's claim that Claudius and Hamlet are actually one and the same, we can even regard the brother murder in Hamlet as actually a father murder, Claudius killing old Hamlet as an allegory of young Hamlet killing old Hamlet. And then the story actually perfectly matches Freud's myth of the symbolic father, the moral voice as the result of the father's being killed by his son or his sons. Dead old Hamlet versus drunk, lecherous Claudius also seem the perfect figuration of the symbolic father versus the primal father. In Hamlet, anyway, we clearly have a collapse of the father function and a father of enjoyment having taken over. The question now again is the solution to this collapse the reinforcement of the symbolic father? The classical reading of Hamlet seems to think so. Hamlet should just have the force to do what his dead father tells him to do. But to me the question is, how should we listen to that voice of the ghost, to the voice of the phantom father? Should we take it as an authority? And is Hamlet's problem really that he does not immediately do what the ghost tells him to do? Wouldn't he rather be a kind of psychotic if he immediately did so? The traditional understanding of the ghost, old Hamlet's ghost, is actually that it is a kind of superego, pronouncing an unambiguous moral command, and Hamlet's problem then being his hesitation to fulfill this command. But what if hesitation is actually the more appropriate response to the address of the ghost? What if Hamlet has got it all wrong when he thinks that the question is to be or not to be? The ghost, anyhow, seems to undermine the binary opposition of this question, as it neither is nor is not. The ghost is beyond ontology, that is, beyond the question of being, as I read it, and rather takes us into the domain of ethics. The question is not whether the ghost exists. The point is that it does insist. This way, another possible reading of the ghost opens. Instead of seeing it as an allegory of the superego, the voice of conscience, one may see it as an allegory of the unconscious. The unconscious precisely does not exist, but it insists. That's what Lacan tells us, anyhow. So if one does not take the message of the ghost too literally, if one does allow oneself to hesitate before the ghost and does not immediately listen to it as the superego, it may open up an ethics beyond the moral of the superego and the law. That is, beyond the moral of the symbolic father and his founding exception, the primal father. That is, an ethics of the unconscious being the ethics of openness to the other. This implies a turn from questioning the ghost state of being to taking seriously, but not literally, its address, which then becomes another kind of address than the unambiguous commandment, which demands a certain ontological state of the commander, be he father, god, or super ego. Very roughly, I read Hamlet as a play about incestuous blurring versus splitting. Claudius is the one who is incestuously blurring all lines by killing his brother and marrying his sister-in-law. Thus, he is truly a violator of that principle of borders and difference, which is the function of the symbolic father. And you can see this in his rhetorics right from the start. He, for instance, he calls Hamlet my cousin and my son, and he refers to Gertrude as our sometimes sister, now our queen. That's in his rhetorics. You can see all the time this figure where he kind of presents opposites, but in a syntax that denies opposition. It's as if there were really no opposition between my cousin, between being my cousin and being my son, being my sister, now my queen. As one might say, if the most famous line from the play, if Hamlet's to be or not to be, that is the question. If this line was pronounced by Claudius, I'm sure he would say to be and not to be. No problem. So he's the one to represent this incestuous dissolution of opposition and difference. And against this, Hamlet puts clear binary opposition. When, for instance, he is comparing old Hamlet to the sun god Hyperion, and Claudius to a beastly satyr. And of course, this most famous line of Hamlet's is pure antithesis, to be or not to be. Now, this clear-cut antithesis might look like a solution to the incestuous blurring, but Hamlet's antithesis had the character of splitting, which is, as psychoanalysis knows, never a solution. Moreover, the logic of the plot will have it that this attempt, Hamlet's attempt, to violently draw the line that murder and incest have dissolved, actually results in complete incestuous dissolution. In the final scene, Hamlet finally takes his sword and sticks it into Claudius. And this could have been and should have been the clear-cut, the reinstallment of that line, that difference that Claudius has blurred. But it is not. Actually, the final scene of Hamlet is one big incestuous orgy where everyone is being penetrated by the same poisonous sword, and everybody is drinking from the same poisonous cup. You have those almost comical confusion, like Gertrude drinking from the poison cup that was meant for Hamlet, Hamlet killing Laertes and Claudius by the same poisonous sword that was meant to kill himself, the English ambassador suddenly entering and crying that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. It's like comedy, actually, if it were not so sad. But my point is that there is a third alternative in the play to incestuous blurring and splitting antithesis. And this principle might simply be called difference. Difference as something else than splitting. This principle is at work in Hamlet's lines when he is witty, when he is just giving himself into the play of language, and those puns based on ambiguity and subtle difference rather than splitting and antithesis. To push things a little, one might say that the witty Hamlet is producing free associations, And the one who has an ear for this is Polonius. Polonius having this line saying, listen to the mad Hamlet, and then wondering, though it be madness, yet there's method in it. Polonius here actually, as I read him, prefiguring Freud, willing to listen to the method of the madness of Hamlet's free associations. But Hamlet does not really like free associations, though he's so brilliant at producing them. He wants the free player language to end. The points that stop the free player language are what Lacan calls master signifiers. And the play actually proposes three major master signifiers, that is, signifiers that can stop the production of still more words, words, words. And the one is, of course, the father's voice. The moment this voice is heard as an unambiguous and literal commandment. The second one is the king's seal. When the letter ordering Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to be killed is provided with the king's seal, its words becomes a deed. The naming of killing becomes actually killing. If you have this letter saying Rosencrantz and Guildenstern should be killed, the king's seal is the master signifier, kind of guaranteeing, well, this is where you should not take this as some kind of free association to produce further meaning. This is where meaning stops. They should be killed. It's what linguistics would call a performative, actually acting through words. But only because you have this master signifier, the king's seal in this case. So the father's voice as one master signifier, the king's seal as the second one, and the third one is, of course, the skull, Yorick's skull. The skull kind of stopping and sucking up any production of meaning as Hamlet is staring into it while he is not pronouncing the famous line, to be or not to be, even if we have a tendency to think that the line and the gesture with the skull are connected. He's not actually talking about, he's not saying to be or not to be when he is with Yorick's skull. He's actually talking about women's makeup. Because what he's saying when staring to the skull is, now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her, let her paint an inch thick to this favor she must come. Make her laugh at that. And actually I see in this line a kind of Hamlet's misogyny being related to his being stuck with ontology. It is because to be or not to be is a great question for Hamlet that he can't really tolerate the feminine masquerade, and actually what he is talking about when standing with the skull is women's makeup. Well, but by proposing the voice of the ghost as an address to be taken seriously, but not literally, I would propose to release it from the function of the master signifier. Release it from the place where meaning is fixed. And making it rather into a signifier of the unconscious, the place where meaning is never fixed. The ethical position in Hamlet would then not be the obedience to the commandment of the dead father, but the openness to that other and strange voice that talks to us from unknown places, the voice of the unconscious that does not fix any meaning, but rather starts an endless production of meaning. Now, one who has been listening with very sensitive attention to the ghost of old Hamlet is Jacques Derrida, who writes about the figure of the ghost in his Spectre de Marx. And with Derrida, the ghost actually becomes a kind of teacher. And talking about the ghost of old Hamlet, Derrida actually makes him also into some kind of teacher, but not of the master kind. Someone whose address can teach us, but not as the teacher, as the father teaches the son in that tradition of patriarchal apprentice. And the other great ghost in Spectre de Marx is, of course, Marx and the whole specter of communism that Marx and Engels wanted to haunt Europe. A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism, as it is written in the Communist Manifesto. And Marx is, according to Derrida, one of the ghosts that we must not forget in our allegedly post-communist era. Well, the one who would know how to answer the address of the ghost in Derrida's text, the one who would understand it as something else than a master or a father issuing commands, and who would not care about its ontological status, whether it is or is not. Derrida's ghost actually becomes a figure of that which Emmanuel Levinas would call the other. One might say, perhaps, that Derrida wants us to respond to the ghost as to the Levinasian other, rather than to the Lacanian big other. The Lacanian big other would be the master, the one actually telling you what to do, having the answer, where the Levinasian other would be rather this kind of unknown other being defined by its very otherness. And that's somehow just as I would like Hamlet to respond to the ghost, not as to a paternal commandment, but rather as to the stranger in his own midst. To Derrida, the ghost is a guest to be mourned. And at the same time, a guest is always a ghost, always to be mourned. Between hospitality and mourning, there is a certain affinity, writes Derrida. How could this be? According to Derrida's text, we can only welcome the new as return, we can only welcome the guest as ghost. The ghost is the guest, or hospitality is to welcome the ghost, because that openness to the other, which is hospitality, finds its radical expression in the openness to the ghost. Put in another way, the ghost is a radical allegory of the other, the one coming not only from another place, but also from another time, the one shaking our basic epistemological categories, not at least the categorical ontological divide between to be and not to be. So, I hope, by way of Freud's Moses and Shakespeare's Hamlet, to have pointed to the ethics of the unconscious and the ethics of difference as another possible response to the voice of the dead father or the collapse of the father function, than the reinforcement of paternal authority. Thank you. Moving, very touching, and very, very rich. Thank you a lot. I now have the pleasure to introduce the discussant of this keynote session. That's Judith Leary. She is well known to ISTO members. She has been on the board of ISTO. She lectures in English literature at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And about 15 years ago, she became passionately interested in group relations. That's her own words. I asked her to give me some ideas what to say. But this group relation interest, she has developed alongside her work as a literary critic. She is currently a chairperson of the OFIC, the Israel Association for the Study of Group and Organizational Processes. So I welcome you as a discussant. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Lillian, for this very rich, complex and erudite paper. It really aroused so much in me, it was very, very difficult to pick and choose something for a response, and I rather think I decided unconsciously perhaps to follow your own message and to talk from two very strong associations that I had to your paper. I really like your central thesis of the ghost as the radical allegory of the unconscious other with its focus on ethics. It seems to me to carry with it both a moral and political message, chiefly of openness, behooving us to open up a space for the unconscious other, whether coming from the past, encountered in our present, or even signaling the future. So I'm going to try and relate to these ideas, as I said, from two personal associations that I had while reading the paper. The first association I had was to the female ghost in Jane Eyre, the ghost of Thornfield Hall, who roams about the house at night. This ghost has no message, but as most of you, I'm sure, remember, on the day of Jane the governess's wedding to her employer, Mr. Rochester, she is dramatically revealed to be none other than Bertha, Mr. Rochester's mad first wife, who has been locked up in the attic for years. Just to refresh your memory of the story, when Rochester's marriage is revealed, Jane runs away, Bertha burns down Thornfield Hall with herself in it, seriously injuring Mr. Rochester in the process. Finally, Jane comes back having inherited a fortune and marries the partially crippled Rochester. I wondered why this was my first association to the paper. This female ghost is very different from the ghost of old Hamlet in that she does not explicitly reveal herself and has no command for action on any part of any of the protagonists. Moreover, ultimately there is no ontological question, as she turns out not to be a ghost at all. Rather, she is a living, breathing woman, although described as a subhuman creature, and I'm quoting from Jane Eyre. What it was, whether beast or human being, one could not at first sight tell. It groveled seemingly on all fours. It snatched and growled like some strange wild animal, unquote. Furthermore, in a brilliant rewrite of the life of Bertha, Jean Rhys, in her 20th century novel, Whites of Gassousie, which is a kind of prequel to Jane Eyre, fleshes out the ghost even further, giving us her life in the West Indies before being coerced into marrying Rochester,
an act which ultimately causes her madness and leads her to renewal to England to become the mad Bertha in the attic. This Bertha, born Antoinette Causeway, is the victim of colonization and prejudice, one whose otherness cannot be tolerated or contained by Rochester. In both Jane Eyre and in White's Agassiz, the madness is transmitted from mother to daughter, constituting perhaps an alternative narrative of cultural advance to the father-son narrative implied in Hamilton Freud. But in White's Agassiz, it is a madness induced by the masculine, whether in the form of powerful coercive husbands or in the form of the power of imperialism. Then it occurred to me that perhaps this female ghost, the ghost of the mad wife in the attic, is the ghost of the female other in the cultural discourse within both you and I are working, Lilia. And this led me to an overwhelming, though by no means original question, which I posed to myself as well as to you. Is this ghostly position, and the one of the mad, locked-up wife at that, ultimately the only female position available in the discourse of the evolution of culture? For although the very convincing connection you make between the unconscious ethics and the other seems genderless until it comes full circle back to the desire of the father, which is something that Vivian had in the written part of the lecture, which she didn't get to. And although Lacan's name of the father is a function, a signifier, and not a man. And finally, although in the sibling culture you evoke there is no predominance of males over females, I couldn't help noticing that here we are, three women, playing handmaidens to a discourse in which culture is handed down from father to son, and where there is no fully-fledged female presence, which is not some form of appendage or necessary negative image to the masculine. And just, you don't have any way of knowing this, but the other two Kainak lectures are all male affairs. Also, the only female presence in your paper, aside from Juliet McCannell, is ghostly. Lacan's woman, who according to Lacan does not really exist. There was another reference to the makeup, which is another aspect of feminism. To take my question a step further, is it possible that we, and I include myself in the company of those for whom Freud and Lacan have constituted masters' fathers, are also caught up in something that Lacan has called the desire of the father? And is there any way out of this position? To come back to the role of Bertha, the mad woman in the attic, in the context of Jane Eyre, she has been seen in different ways, but the most persuasive interpretation for me is that of the eminent feminist post-colonial critic Gayatri Spivak, who in light of the writing of White's Agassiz, views Bertha as the colonial other that must be sacrificed so that Jane will be able to take her place as one of the greatest heroines of English literature, the first feminist woman of independent means, morally upright and able to take care of her crippled husband. That the sacrificed Bertha happens to be not only mad, but another kind of other, a Creole from the West Indies, takes us into another whole realm, which I can't develop here, of the ways the powerful West has used others to establish its hegemony. For the purposes of our discussion, though, it seems that in Jane Eyre, for the resolution, for the emergence of a young woman who can take her place alongside men, in order for this resolution to be achieved, a split has to take place between the masculine attributes of power and independence and the irrational, the passionate, the other, which must be repressed and destroyed. Are these positions then, sacrifice, madness, and self-destruction, what Bertha holds for culture? Or alternatively, coming back to your paper, Lillian, is she, us, one of the others that we might possibly meet when following living us into the unconscious? And what will happen when we meet it? I would like to conclude briefly with my second association to your paper, which was no less powerful. The association is biblical. The words uttered by Joseph to his brothers when, after being sold by them to Egypt, he reencounters them as the most powerful man in Egypt after Pharaoh. And the words are, "Doth my father yet live?" Ha'olav Yichai in Hebrew. Surely one of the most poignant utterances in the history of Western civilization. Joseph, as you may recall, is the favorite of his father Jacob, driven by envy arising, among other things, from Joseph's dreams in which his whole family worships him. His brothers sell him into slavery in Egypt, where he becomes a successful and powerful man, thanks mainly to his ability to interpret dreams. During a debilitating drought in Canaan, his brothers are sent by their father to Egypt to try to get some food, which is where they encounter Joseph, who, after tormenting them in all kinds of ways, reveals himself to them. The story concludes with Jacob being reunited with Joseph in Egypt, and finally, after the death of Jacob, Joseph taking him back to Canaan to be buried. This is also the concluding chapter in the stories of the patriarchs in Genesis, and it is followed after an interim by the period of Moses. Time is too short to explore all the avenues opened up here in relation to Freud, Joseph, and Moses. Suffice to mention, perhaps, that Freud, although he did not write extensively about Joseph, identified with him both as a dreamer and as an interpreter of dreams, and referred to him obliquely, especially in the period between the death of his own father and the writing of The Interpretation of Dreams, which he himself acknowledged was partly a way to process his own reaction to his father's death. Jacob, of course, was also the name of Freud's father. I'm very indebted to my colleague, Professor Ruth Ginsburg, for bringing these connections to my attention. It would be interesting then to explore further the relative positions held by these two biblical figures, Joseph and Moses, both of whom matured away from their families and communities, and both Egyptianized, to explore their role in Freud's development and in the development of psychoanalysis, one at the beginning of his career and one at the end, one as a son and one as a father leader himself. Obviously, again, there's no time to go into that, but at the moment, I just want to end with two observations. One is actually a question and another a comment. The question is it possible that Freud's preoccupation with Moses and Joseph teaches us at least as much about Freud and the development of psychoanalysis as it does about whether or not the Jews have a stable identity? Surely Freud's anxieties about succession were partly the trigger for writing both Totem and Taboo and Moses and Monotheism. Incidentally, historically, there's absolutely no evidence to support any of Freud's theses about Moses. And finally, a comment. To return to Joseph's question, "Doth my father yet live?" I would like to see it, as you, Lillian, suggest, as a call of and from the unconscious. It embodies, pun intended, both the longing for the absent haunting father that should perhaps be more openly acknowledged, and the need for independence, "Doth my father yet live?" For as long as the father lives, one can only be a son. Thank you.